From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the offices of a Mexican newspaper called El Siglo de Torreón. Over a span of several years, armed groups attacked that newspaper five times. The groups kidnapped journalists. They wanted the reporters to stop covering drug cartels and related stories. In Mexico, freedom of the press is not exactly a fully protected idea. In 2016 alone, 12 journalists were killed. Nearly that many were murdered last year. And when a journalist is targeted, reporters often notice that government investigators tend to invent motives. Maybe it was a crime of passion or revenge, anything but a targeted hit based on what the reporter was writing. Javier Garza worked at El Siglo de Torreón. He's a journalist based in northern Mexico, an advisor on journalist safety at the World Association of Newspapers, and he was a night fellow at the International Center for Journalists. Today, Garza is in Rochester. He'll offer a public presentation tonight at RIT, comparing coverage of immigration in the United States and Mexico. This hour, he's our guest on Connections, and we're going to discuss coverage of immigration, journalist safety, and what a free press really means. Señor Garza, welcome to Connections. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me, and also thank you for RIT for the invitation.
Yeah, and you're here as a guest of RIT, and Andrea Hickerson is the director of the School of Communication at RIT. I know you're excited, is sort of a strange word because these are tough topics, but I think you're eager to hear what Javier has to say, and I know you want to say a few things about what you've got going on tonight, Andrea.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm particularly thrilled because Javier and I went to graduate school together at the University of Texas, so we've known each other for a long time. Javier is part of International Education Week, which is a kind of a national thing that the United States has to get students more interested in international education and studying abroad. And he will be giving a public talk tonight from 5 to 6:30 on the RIT campus in the new Magic Spell Studios, and that's open to the public.
All right. Again, what time tonight?
5 to 6:30.
5 to 6:30, open to the public this evening. Now, Javier, there's a lot that we could focus on. I do kind of want to start just by asking you how you see the question of what a free press really is. In this country, we have a presidential administration that is routinely mocking and not just mocking, but calling the press an enemy of the people. And I'm wondering if you see any parallels at all, because we still don't often see journalists targeted, though it does happen in this country, do you see any parallels to concerns about press freedom here and in Mexico?
I see parallels insofar as, there is a global trend for political leaders and political actors to have paint or portray the media as enemies. Because we're not seeing this only in the United States. I mean, we're seeing this we just saw this in Brazil with the guy that won the presidential election. We've seen this in Mexico with Andrés Manuel López Obrador. President-elect takes office in 3 weeks, and he rails against the media that he doesn't like, the same way that Donald Trump rails against the New York Times or CNN. Whereas here, the president talks about fake media or failing media. In Mexico, the president-elect puts it more in a different tone. He talks about the bourgeois media as opposed to the interests of the people, for example. But it's in deep down, it's the same. It's just disparaging coverage that you don't like, and we're seeing this trend in other countries. I think it's a global trend fueled by the development of communications, the rise of the development of technology, communications technology, the rise of social media, political polarization, different factors weighing in on this. In Mexico, it's different because we also have other factors, criminal organizations targeting the media, aided by impunity, by a weak rule of law, that means that they can target and they can kill a journalist or beat or kidnap the journalist and get away with it because the guy that did it before got away with it. And so that's another force also playing against journalism. But I will say this about the United States. Big difference is that you can have the president of the United States rail against the media the way he does, and you can have the president of Mexico, say, rail against the media the way he does, or any other hostile actor, against the media. If a follower of the president of the United States would start to take that into a physical action, you know, like, say, beat up a journalist or, as we just saw, deliver a bomb to a news organization, he would get arrested, right, as happened here. And that would give the next guy who's thinking about this maybe some pause that if it's probably not a good idea to do it, right? That doesn't happen in Mexico. If somebody were to take, you know, physical action against a journalist or against the news organization, odds are nothing would happen to that person. And that's the big difference, I think, between Mexico and the United States.
And there's not, forgive my ignorance, there's not optimism that the incoming leader of Mexico isn't going to be any better with that.
Not in this regard. He still has to be tested, right? It's pretty easy if you're in the opposition to criticize a government for saying, you know, they haven't solved any attack against journalists. They haven't solved any of the killings of journalists. But now he's going to be head of a government in 3 weeks. And now he's going to own every case that happens on his watch, as well as the investigations that have not yielded any results. Now he's going to own it. And I don't see how he can deliver.
You told NPR Scott Simon about this trend of investigators blaming attacks on journalists on anything other than the actual work of journalism. Why do they do this? And tell me more about that.
You tend to disparage the victim and say, you know, a journalist gets killed. So the initial reaction from the investigator, which is, let's say, the equivalent of the district attorney or the sheriff's department, which in Mexico is run at the state level, state government. Their initial reaction would be he was into something, he was in some shady business, he owed money, he was having an affair, you know, or something like that. Anything but a professional motive, because authorities do not want to admit that they have a problem in their hands, the problem of not being able to guarantee the free exercise of the press, right, to guarantee a safe environment for journalists. It makes them look bad. So because they don't want to admit that they have that problem, well, then they try to look away. Also, you don't see it just in violence against the media. You see it, for example, also in gender violence. They do not want to issue the alerts about domestic violence, even in the face of women getting killed by their sentimental couples or by their spouses or boyfriends or whatever. But they don't want to attribute it to a gender-based motive, because that would mean that they have a bigger problem in their hands. And so it happens that way. You don't want to attribute it to a specific case because you don't want to admit that you just can't provide for a safe environment for journalists.
I have to say, Andrea Hickerson, I wonder if you would have the same observation. When Javier talks about this idea that, well, a journalist gets killed and investigators find a way to try to blame the victim or find something to say, well, you know, he was caught up in such and such. That's often the way reporters in our country report about people of color who are shot by police. That's one of the parallels I see. And I'm not sure it's fully parallel to the way they talk about journalists in Mexico. But this notion of, well, the guy who was killed by a woman, a police officer who came into his apartment in thinking it was her own, and she shoots and kills him. Well, he did have a little marijuana on him. You know, it's just what they do. And that's one of the parallels I'm sort of hearing in my mind as I listen to Javier. Do you agree?
I think so. I mean, I think so often we look at crimes as kind of the personification of somebody's faults. And it's very hard to step back. And I think now we're seeing some movement away from that with this idea of solutions journalism, that, you know, maybe there is a bigger problem and we should find a better way to talk about it. But absolutely, I think, you know, we focus on individuals and stories kind of like as characters, and that we're going to learn something great if we just dig deeper into that individual's lives. And I think sometimes by focusing on those details, we do miss the bigger picture and being able to weave stories together.
Hmm. But I will say
yeah, please do.
No, I will say this, if I may.
Yeah.
I agree with Andre. I agree with your parallelism. We also see that in Mexico, not attributed to ethnic or race-based, but socioeconomic. You know, if you see, I mean, it happened in, I live in a town that in 2012, in a city that in 2012 was seeing an average of 3 homicides a day. And people were sort of getting inured to that. You know, they were getting jaded. And if somebody, you know, a body turned up on the street and they would say, well, no, he was just into drug dealing, right? Usually a young guy from one of the poorest parts of town, or maybe from out of town, low socioeconomic status, and they would say, well, because he was, then he deserved it, right? And you sort of get jaded to, and so that prevents you from admitting that you have a bigger violence problem.
Listeners, as we have a conversation this hour with Javier Garza, a journalist from Mexico, speaking at RIT today, we will talk more about journalist safety, freedom of the press, and we're going to talk about immigration and how issues are covered in the United States vis-a-vis Mexico. You can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. When you were working for El Siglo de Torreón and there were multiple attacks, what were the attacks like? What was it like working there?
Well, I would say it was very exciting working there. I mean, running a local newspaper, running a local newsroom is a great professional challenge, at least for me. Different from working, like, say, at a big Mexico City newspaper, which I also did, because that usually tend to deal with more abstract issues. You know, it was like more, if you would put it in U.S. terms, like inside the Beltway stuff. But when you went to work for a local news organization, you saw that you had more immediate impact. But then, as I was working there, and the city became this ground in a turf war between two drug cartels, and we realized that one of the first things that drug cartels tried to do when they were battling each other is to try to control the message and try to control what people were saying about them. And so they had different ways of intimidating. It would be through threats. They attacked the newspaper 5 times. They shot at the newspaper in 5 occasions in response to some of the coverage that we had done.
When you say shot, like shot out the windows?
Or? No, well, the newspaper, fortunately, the newspaper is, the building is a really ugly building because it is a cube. Basically, it's just a windowless cube.
You're describing a lot of newsrooms.
Well, yeah, it's a windowless cube, right?
Yeah.
But it turned out to be a blessing, right? Except for, and well, the first 2 attacks were at night when the newspaper was closed. There were no injuries or anything. It was just like a message. The second time, they also exploded a car outside the main entrance. They just, you know, parked the car on the curb, sprayed it with gasoline, and set it on fire, just in case we didn't get the message with the hail of AK-47 bullets. And then we also suffered the kidnapping of 5 people, also as a way to deliver a message that we should tone down the coverage that we had been doing of different episodes of violence in the city. You know, these one group in particular was torching some businesses. It was attacking some businesses. It was staging shootouts with federal police officers. We were covering that. They didn't like the way that we were covering that, so they kidnapped 5 people, random workers from the newspaper, not even reporters or editors, just random workers. And, you know, basically as a way to deliver a message that we should tone the coverage down.
Did it work? Did you make any changes?
We toned it down a little bit. You know, like say if we put it in the front page, you know, maybe not put it in the front page anymore. We didn't stop covering it. But we sort of like took it off the front page, and tried to report it in a more like sober way. Yeah.
Did you do that because you were convinced that if you kept going the same way that they would kill your staff?
Yeah. Yeah, because see, you're convinced basically that you don't have any protection, right? You're convinced because that attack was possible because the people who shot at the building got away with it, right? I mean, our first attack was in August of 2009. Nobody was caught. Nobody was even identified as the people responsible. So I guess that allowed the next attack, which happened in 2011, because they saw that, you know, the people had gotten away with it. And so that impunity is what also drove us to develop our own measures of protection, safety protocols and such. And so we knew that, you know, if we didn't address the situation, nobody was going to do it for us. We didn't count on the government stepping in. And actually, it actually became worse because, you know, when the federal government offered us protection, they sent a group of federal police agents to guard the offices. And that provoked three armed attacks on three consecutive days. I mean, these guys would just, you know, drive up and start shooting at the police guys, right? In one of those shootouts, you know, when in those shootouts, the bullets did penetrate the building because it was in the afternoon and the building was open, right? And people were, most of my staff was there. It was even more traumatic for us. And, you know, the first attack happened and then nothing happened. So that allowed the second attack and then nothing happened and that allowed the third attack. It was, to a response that even the government was looking ridiculous, you know, because they weren't even being able to stop this.
Yeah. So Javier, when I ask, did you continue to cover it? I think everyone listening is hoping you're going to say, we didn't make any changes at all, you know?
No, it doesn't work like that.
You literally could have been dead for it. And I think the hard part for journalists in these kind of scenarios is to say, if we don't really feel protected, can we continue to cover this at all? If we do, can we do it in a way that benefits the public while make sure that we are not going to be targeted in a fatal way?
You can adjust it. One thing that we never went into was self-censorship, like totally censor coverage of violent episodes. We never went to that extreme. What we did was adjust the coverage, you know, and maybe it's okay. Say we're not going to put it in the front page anymore. But even, you know, as time went by, almost ratified the wisdom of the decision because you said murders, homicides weren't news anymore. You know, if you had three happening every day, two or three happening every day, sometimes you had days with seven or eight. That wasn't news anymore. You know, getting people every day, it really defies the definition of news, right? So we published them, you know, online and in the newspaper. We just didn't plaster them on the front page anymore. And we would, you know, treat them basically the same. We also realized that the way that the criminals were committing their crimes was also a way to send a message. It's one thing to kill somebody and just dump the body in the street, and it's another thing to kill that person, decapitate it, or mutilate the body into pieces and throw them in different parts of the city, which happened. But you don't really want that in your front page, right?
So what I want to do is sort of draw an important, I think, a parallel to United States journalism, and not overdraw that parallel because, you know, we generally don't have our offices, and I don't mean WXXI, I mean across the country, journalistic offices are generally not targeted in violent ways, though they have been at times. So that distinction is important. But in Mexico, you didn't feel that the government really was even investigating very, very seriously. And when the government does investigate when journalists are targeted, they're not all that helpful. In this country, you have some government leaders decide, well, that if I don't like the way the news media covers me, I'm just not going to engage with them. Chris Collins was just apparently closely reelected to Congress here. He's under indictment. He on Election Day said, well, we have a strategy and we're not talking to journalists anymore. And we have mayors and we have governors and we have a president and we have state senators who decide they don't have to talk to journalists anymore, that they can do it their way, that they can talk directly to the people, not realizing that what they're endorsing is state-run media when there's no actual support of journalism. So I think whether it's Mexico or the United States, we really ought to have a standard that tells people who want to run for office, if you want to run for office, you must engage with journalists and with the news media. And even when you don't like the coverage, it's even more important to engage with them because that is the basis of a free society.
Yeah, I agree. But I just think that times are changing in a way that is basically reducing the incentive for public officials to do that. They came to recognize that the media is vulnerable. I mean, they came to recognize that the media is shrinking in their audiences. In some cases, not in all cases, and certainly in many local markets. In Mexico, there used to be a time when local media was, you know, powerful, where government, public government officials, public elected officials had to respond to the requests of reporters, had to, you know, engage with them because they needed the coverage. Now, if they feel that they don't need the coverage. And I think that's something that's been going on with this intermediation, if you will. I don't like to use these words, but I think that's, you know, removing the intermediary. Social media has allowed.
So through YouTube, through social media, they can speak directly to people.
Yes.
They don't need journalists to do it.
Well, I mean, I'm a journalist. I mean, I tell you that they should need journalists to do it. I can understand why they think they don't. They are increasingly seeing us as irrelevant. And I think that's dangerous because you need that intermediary to make sense of a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, so, and I think that's kind of the point I'm making, that if you are in office, if you are a state senator, if you're the president of the United States, if you're the governor of New York or Ohio or Michigan, if you're the mayor of Rochester or the supervisor of the town of Brighton, and you do not think that you have to talk to journalists, you are participating in the erosion of a foundational block of a free society.
Yes, totally.
And this is a zero-sum game. You're either participating in the strengthening or the erosion of it.
Yeah, because, you know, once you feel that there is no need for journalists, then you can basically say whatever you want. And your opponent can say whatever you want. And so the middle is lost and the truth is lost in many cases. Intermediary is an honest broker. But I think the press has been losing that function because, you know, we are the weakening of our business models has made us more vulnerable.
Right. Absolutely right. And, but let me also ask you this, Javier. This would only be effective. The actions of political leaders to circumvent the media would only be effective if the public, if the citizenry, accepts that. But in many cases, they do. Yeah. Why is the public accepting of this?
I think that's also part of a trend. There is more polarization going on. You know, social media, I think, has been one of the main reasons for this. Again, you know, removing the intermediaries. You can say that it's not the only factor, and I would agree because I've seen political polarization, at least in the United States, go way back to, like, at least since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I just couldn't put my finger on one specifically. You know, it's probably more an issue for sociologists or anthropologists, but I would say this, you know, we're losing figures of authority. I think that's mm-hmm. another reason. Institutions are losing credibility all across the board, not just the media. You see government institutions losing credibility. You see religious institutions losing credibility, academic institutions. I think that's also part of a trend that's been going on for decades, mm-hmm. and we're starting to see the fruits of that. In the case of the media, I think that we are probably going back to what the media was like before objective, quote unquote, journalism or modern journalism was invented in the late 1890s. I'm sorry, in the late 19th century. Before that, there was partisan journalism. You know, back in the Civil War, you know, you had your Confederate media and you had your Union media. You know, or in Mexico, it was the same thing back in the Revolution. You know, you had your media back in one side, media back in another side. Partisan media was the same thing in France in the 18th and 19th century. I think we're probably going back to that a little bit. Not from the point of view of the news organizations. I think news organizations are, you know, struggling to keep their even footing. But from the point of view of the news consumer, you're consuming the media that you want, you know, the media that suits you.
Let me read an email from a listener named Andrew, and I'll tell our listeners again, if you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org, or you can call the program 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Andrew wants to know, what do journalists get paid in Mexico? Can they make a living? It's becoming a bigger challenge in the United States. And what parent would tell a child to get into journalism? That hurts.
That last one is a really good question. I don't think any parent would tell a child to go. I think most parents would actually try to discourage them.
In Mexico.
Or everywhere.
I hear that.
And I think that's probably what would make the better journalist, is somebody who keeps doing it against the odds. How much are we paid? Not that much. I mean, I have to say that. And some, maybe you can say that some, and I include myself, are luckier than others because we have been able to get opportunities. But if you go to average, news organization pays journalists very, very little, not enough to make a decent living. They usually have to find income somewhere else, or more perversely and unfortunately, they have to corrupt themselves, you know, and start taking money for favorable coverage or sell your new news content as advertisement. News organizations also don't want to pay journalists what they should be paying them. You know, there is a precarization of labor. It's been going on for a long time. News organizations, you know, owners, managers, they've always turned a blind eye to reporters engaging in the sale of advertisement, for example, or accepting money from the government officials that they cover, because they've always seen that as a way to supplement the income so that they won't have to pay them a higher salary so that they can have bigger profits. It is a problem that's widespread in Mexican media.
My guest is Javier Garza, who is a journalist based in northern Mexico and advisor on journalist safety at the World Association of Newspapers. He was a night fellow at the International Center for Journalists, and he is in Rochester as a guest of RIT. In fact, he's giving a presentation tonight, 5 p.m., and that's at the Magic Center at RIT. It is a free presentation open to the public covering immigration from both sides of the border. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and we'll talk about covering immigration with him next. Coming up in our second hour, a lot of first-timers made runs for political office this year, and some won. We're going to talk about what it takes to run for office. And if you or anyone you know has ever wondered, maybe you thought I'd like to run, or you know someone who you think should run for town council or school board or Congress or the state Senate, we're going to talk about how much advanced planning needs to happen, what kind of a staff, how much money you need to raise, and how you do it, and more next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest is Javier Garza, a journalist who has done work on a number of different platforms. And so as we talk about journalism, it was a great compliment to public media and public radio and WXXI to hear what Mr. Garza had to say during our brief break. Can you share that with the audience?
It is a compliment. I guess you can take it as a compliment. No, it's just weird to go half an hour uninterrupted on radio. I have a radio program and I have commercial breaks every 10 minutes. So I always have to be rushing my guests to, like, you know, hurry up and finish the thought. And now I was, you know, we felt weird that there was nobody rushing me, you know, because we would just keep talking.
That's the best compliment. I think that I do take that as a compliment to Senor Garza. So thank
you.
Well,
no, but that's if you say about, you know, the need for journalism is you need this. You know, you need the free flow of ideas.
Absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. Let me get a phone call. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Javier. Javier, I'm a listener who looks at a lot of and listens to a lot of different media outlets. I listen a lot to NPR. I listen to Fox News. I listen to a lot of talk shows that are both right and left. What I've observed is, as a listener of a lot of media, I've observed a lot of bias by the media, especially on behalf of the left in the at least in the United States. There seems to be a huge bias that what media doesn't report. So the credibility of the media, to many people like myself and others, we've lost our faith in the media and reliability. So when a politician or let's say a sports celebrity, a coach, whatever, won't talk to the media, you know, I can see why in a lot of cases, because the bias reporting, especially to favor the left, is too much to take.
I mean, I agree in general terms that there is a bias. And if you say, okay, there is this, the media has a bias to favor the left, I would say that there is also a segment of the media that has a bias towards the right, right? Fox News, or there's a lot of talk radio.
I agree with that, Javier. Yeah. The problem, though, is that 90% of the media is to the left. Fox News is very popular because the vast majority of the media, I would say 90%. In fact, there was a study done in 2006 by UCLA that at that time, 80% of the media was to the left or favored the left. So I think it's gotten even worse right now. So Fox is very popular because it's one of the few outlets people have to go to. When you consider the full spectrum of the media, the print media, you got the New York Times, the Washington Post, it's the LA Times, etc. Most of the newspapers that I can see, the major newspapers, are far to the left.
All right, so John, stay there, John, because there's a lot here, and there's I do want to let Javier respond to that.
Okay.
I will say that on the subject of 90%, I mean, what John is saying is hard to argue in that the journalists in this country lean left as a group. There are plenty of journalists who lean right. There are organizations that lean right, more lean left than lean right. But it also depends on what you include as journalists. I mean, Sinclair Television dominates local TV news, and if you count local TV news as journalists, some do, some don't, based on the job, then those numbers start to change. But go ahead, Javier.
No, I was going to make a point similar to what Evan is making, John. You're right. CNN has a leftward bias, or the New York Times or the Washington Post. But, you know, they don't reach, you know, not even close to a majority of the public. The bulk of, I think the bulk of the influence is in local media, local TV stations, local newspapers, although newspapers are losing that influence. Nationally syndicated radio and the big TV networks. Even Fox News doesn't reach a lot of people. I mean, you would see, you know, the ratings for the highest rated shows in Fox News are up to 3 million people, you know, 3 million across a universe of 200 million media consumers.
Yeah, and 330 million people.
In the
yeah.
U.S. Yeah. And same for CNN and MSNBC, you know, which are even lower, and I can get that. So I think, you know, you're right in the sense that, yeah, there is a tilt, there is a bias. I think that also there is a segment of people who don't feel represented by the topics, the subjects that CNN or the Times is choosing to cover.
Well, I'll give you an example. I hate to interrupt, but I just wanted to throw this out before I don't want to lose my spot here. The local newspapers, as an example, the Democrat and Chronicle here in Rochester, the Buffalo News, I'm a subscriber of both. Tremendous local bias by reporters. I can document. I actually correspond with many, many reporters.
Give me one reporter at the Democrat and Chronicle who you're talking about.
Let's see. I got a whole, Justin Murphy, Megan McDermott. I have correspondence going back and forth with many local and national reporters on issues that they have reported on, which I think are very biased. And in some cases, they do get back to me. Sometimes they refute what I say. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't respond. But I have a document by the hundreds on a lot of biased reporting on a local and national basis. And I can say I've had a lot of correspondence with Buffalo News reporters, Democrat and Chronicle reporters, even the Rochester Business Journal reporters. On the other side of it, when a story that I think is a good story, I will send an email complimenting them on a story. But most of my correspondence is negative. There's tremendous bias on a local and national basis.
All right, John, thank you for the phone call. I'm just going to defend Megan and Justin, just say that, I mean, I'm constantly grateful for the work of local newspapers, Democrat and Chronicle included. And by the way, what Javier's talking about isn't just the Buffalo News, the Democrat and Chronicle. It's small papers, too. No, it's Batavia. Small. It's a lot of others.
And even you can see a lot of small papers I wouldn't say rightward tendencies, just as I wouldn't say leftward tendencies. They'd say more conservative tendencies.
Sure.
If you go to Texas, for example, you know, small towns in Texas or the Midwest. But, you know, I think we need to be careful in the way we use the terms right and left, conservative or liberal, and we use the term bias. We are falling also into a very dangerous area in which it's biased just because we don't like it, regardless of whether it's true or not, right? And I think that's the most dangerous edge of the term fake news is not necessarily the misinformation, but it's political actors and other actors labeling legitimate journalism as fake news, right? Just because you don't like it. And I think we need to really guard against that. You can say biased journalism just because you don't like it. I would guess a lot of people didn't like the investigations that the Post was doing during Watergate, right? And a lot of people would say that at the time they were biased, but nobody was ever able to dispute the truth. You know, they were true.
John, thank you for the phone call. I want to shift the conversation to some of what Javier Garza, our guest for the hour, a journalist from Mexico with a long resume, and is in Rochester tonight speaking at RIT. In fact, let me ask Andrea Hickerson again to tell us what's coming up tonight, and then we'll talk a little bit about that without giving away the store. Go ahead, Andrea.
Yes, great. Javier is at RIT this week as part of its International Education Week, and he is the keynote speaker. He'll be speaking tonight on coverage of immigration in the United States and Mexico, and that's from 5 to 6:30 in the Magic Spell Studios.
Okay, and so as we talk about how immigration is covered, this is a good example here. I'm going to start with sort of the obvious current political story of the moment, and then we'll talk more broadly. Mm-hmm. How is the question of the caravan from Honduras covered in Mexico?
Well, it's a really complex issue. You can say, okay, how is it being covered? I think, you know, what we're trying to do is just basically cover all of the angles. But the main angle is the humanitarian angle. Which I think is the one that is most easily lost, is why are they fleeing, you know? Why are they risking? I just heard about, was reading the story about this woman who gave birth to a baby, I don't know if it was a son or daughter, during the walk of the caravan in the state of Oaxaca, I think it was. What would propel a woman who is 8 months pregnant to undergo a journey like that? And, you know, if you pose that question, I know that here somebody would say anchor baby or whatever. okay, but she was 8 months pregnant. You know, she wasn't going to get to the United States even in time to deliver that baby. Is that she was fleeing something, you know? What is causing these people to flee? Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. Why are they moving in a caravan also? I think it's also one of the biggest angles that, and this is something that touches especially in Mexico. Because when migrants cross Mexico, they are prey to organized crime who don't only traffic drugs, they also have a huge business in smuggling people and moving people and crossing them to the United States and then employing them in just basically indentured servitude in the United States. And so caravan is just safety in numbers. You know, you move in a group of 4,000 people just so that you won't get kidnapped, you won't get extorted, that you won't get, harassed by criminals, right? So that you can be protected because you're sheltered by a lot of people. And so, of course, criminals don't mess with a mass of 4,000 people that is being accompanied by security forces that is being watched by humanitarian international organizations. That's also a very important aspect, and it's shameful to Mexico. Why must it be a caravan? Because you know you say they have to move this way throughout our country, because they can't move freely within our country, and also that's another dimension of it. You know, and of course the origin, the causes of the caravans. I think that's the most important story. Why is it happening? And you can say, why is it happening now? It's really not clear the origin, but there is a migrant caravan every year. There was one in April. They always organize it around Holy Week every year for the past 10 years. But nobody seemed to be paying any attention to that back then.
And now let's look at immigration more broadly, and I'm wondering how the notion of immigration, both documented and undocumented, into the United States from Mexico is covered inside of Mexico.
Well, we tend to look at historically, and not just in immigration, but historically, we tend to look at the United States as, you know, like an adversary. It's a love-hate relationship because it has evolved also because of our economic integration. We look up to the United States in many things, but we like to criticize the United States in a lot of things. And like many people, we like to criticize others in the stuff where we know we are failing, you know. So we say, Americans treat immigrants shamefully, you know. But we don't want to admit that people have to immigrate because we can't, our countries can't provide employment, education, health, just basic livelihood. So we want to criticize the U.S. for the way it treats the immigrants because we don't want to acknowledge the reason why they are immigrating. Mexico and other Central American countries, but mostly Mexico, has to be the only country in the world that is asking another country to take care of its citizens. You know, when Mexico has been pressing for legalization or for regularization of undocumented people, it's not saying, you know, we are going to provide the economic conditions so that they can have productive lives in Mexico. That it has been happening quietly for the past few years in which economic development in Mexico is lowering immigration to the United States. The immigration to the United States from Mexicans is net zero. You mm-hmm. know, as many people going up as coming back.
That I think is something that a lot of Americans don't fully understand.
No, because it's not net zero when you add the Central Americans. That net zero effect with Mexicans sort of compensates that it doesn't go higher, right? But because it's pretty high, mostly fueled by Hondurans, Salvadorans,
traveling through Mexico.
Well, for Mexico, it's net zero.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that net zero is erased when you add people from other countries. But there is a broader angle to immigration that also receives a lot of coverage in Mexico, and that is, what are the stories of the immigrants? How are they doing in the United States, right? And so you see, in some cases, as a point in pride, you know, Mexicans succeeding in the United States. Again, you don't really acknowledge that they would never have succeeded that way if they had stayed in Mexico. But, you know, that's also a big factor in coverage.
Okay. And when it comes to the economic health, I mean, you raise a point that's certainly indisputable, which is when Mexico sees economic improvement, there will be fewer who want to flee Mexico,
right,
for obvious reasons. I wonder how NAFTA and the new, I guess it's the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, but essentially it's NAFTA 2.0, how it's viewed. One of the caricatures of NAFTA in this country is that when NAFTA passed in the 1990s, a good number of American companies or multinationals sent jobs from the United States to Mexico because they could pay them very poor wages under very different conditions and improve their profit margins in Mexico. Is it viewed that way there? And how is the agreement viewed now?
Well, no, it wasn't viewed that way in Mexico because we were the ones getting the jobs.
But were they good jobs?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. They were, you wouldn't have the same standard of living if you work at a car factory in Mexico as somebody that works in the assembly lines in the United States. Certainly not. But they were, you know, they lifted a lot of people from poverty. They urbanized a lot of people and gave them access to services that they did not have. So it did have an impact, a positive impact, in Mexico. There are gains and losses for everyone in an agreement like that. And I would agree that, yes, the United States has a very justified reason to say, yeah, NAFTA took away jobs from the United States. But it also created a lot of jobs. It also created a lot of jobs in high tech, in other sectors. It freed a lot of the workforce to go and work in other stuff, especially technology, I would say, that is revolutionizing the world, global economy. It also, and I think this is also a very important point, it made things very cheaper in the United States. If you take into account how much does it cost to buy a car, also as a fraction of your income, or a washing machine, or a microwave oven, or a television, things like that. It turns out that they're cheaper. There was a chart that was put out when NAFTA was begun to be renegotiated a few months ago, showing how an American car, a standard, I think it was a Ford Focus, would cost about $2,000 more if it was made totally in the United States. So that also has an impact. There was a sense of in Mexico that there was no reason to open up NAFTA, maybe updated with some copyright protections and some e-commerce, electronic commerce issues, because NAFTA, of course, was negotiated in 1993, 92, way before the internet. And so maybe do a little update. And those updates did happen in the new version, but there really was no reason to mess with it the way they did.
Javier Garza has been our guest for the hour, and you can meet him tonight. Andrea Hickerson is the director of the School of Communication at RIT. One more time, what's going on tonight?
Yes, Javier is the keynote speaker for International Education Week, and he'll be speaking about differing coverage of immigration between the U.S. and Mexico. And the talk is from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at Magic Spell Studios on the RIT campus.
To the extent that it means anything to you, I just want to offer you thanks and gratitude and solidarity and continued good health and good work for you and your many colleagues across Mexico. I appreciate your insight this hour, and it's a bit of a strange time. I think your insights are really valued on the program today, but here's to continued many more years of success and good work.
No, thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Javier Garza, our guest for the hour. All right, we're going to get a short break here, and much more connections is straight ahead when we're going to talk about politics in our next hour. A lot of people have been sort of musing about the changes, especially in the last week when it comes to American politics. And if you have never run for office before, but you've thought about it, or there's someone you know, or maybe you think, well, I think so-and-so should do it. We're going to answer the question next hour. Everything that it takes to run for office, how much planning, how much money, how much time, we'll answer all of that coming up.